Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team.
All right, so we're here with Kyle Richless. He's a reformed attorney and chief conversation starter at Axiom Law. Today, we're going to start off talking about quota. We're going to pivot into talking about compensation and then dive into the meat of recruiting. Kyle, thanks for jumping on the show today, man.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. We are big predictable revenue fans here at Axiom. We've implemented a lot of Aaron's methodology, specializing in the sales funnel, which is something that we've really done over the past few years at Axiom. In fact, I told Aaron this when I met him in San Francisco last week, but whenever a salesperson starts at Axiom, particularly here on the East Coast, we give them a copy of the book. So we're pretty big fans. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Okay. Perfect. If you're a real fan, you give them two copies of the book.
I should.
And make him go into Amazon and review.
Aaron, I need some autographed books from you to give everyone too.
Yeah, honestly, if you ship me out a box and with some way to ship them back, then I'll get to them at some point.
I'll take you up on it.
Cool. I'll arrange the details after the call here. Perfect. Let's before we jump into quota, one thing I think we glossed over that would add some context here. You guys are, because I think the whole sort of interview and everything we've got that we want to talk about today, this will add some really nice context. But can you tell us a little bit about Axiom Law and the niche that you guys are focused on?
Absolutely. So Axiom Law is a new model alternative legal services provider. This category of alternative legal services providers, I credit our founders with creating. It's an emerging space. So I'll give you a little bit of context about why we were created in the first place. And I think that'll help you to understand who we serve. And so, as you know, the internet is ravishing everything and every industry is being disrupted. You can name a million disruptive companies off the top of your head, and mobile is helping that. And how ubiquitous and free information is coming is also helping that. But the interesting thing about legal is the legal industry really hasn't changed. So if you look back over decades or even a century, it's the same way that legal services have been delivered, which is by and large big law firms with partners presiding over armies of junior attorneys, and the partners are making a killing financially as the junior attorneys or the junior associates are doing the drudge work of looking up precedent or going through case law, et cetera. And so our founding premise was there's got to be a better way to do this, a better way to deliver legal services to clients that are more economical. And there's got to be a better way of practitioners to practice that afford them some variety and flexibility and control over their career. And so Axiom created a marketplace where high caliber legal services are available flexibly and on demand. And because we've eliminated the operating overhead and we've eliminated the partnership model, the legal services they cost a fraction of what a traditional legal service provider or a law firm would cost. And so we are selling to chief legal officers at some of the biggest companies in the world. So if you look at a Baldrige investment bank or a big pharmaceutical company or a big tech company, by and large, they have large in-house legal teams. But those in-house legal teams are still complemented and supplemented by big law firms that might do big litigation matters or M&A matters or anything under the sun. And so instead, Axiom attorneys come and join these in-house legal departments purchased by, say, the general counsel or chief legal officer of a Fortune 500 company.
Gotcha. And I think that adds just the perfect amount of context here. So let's jump into, talking about your quota. So we're going to pivot completely, and then we'll come back to why that little introduction was important. So totally. Can you tell me about your quota for the year?
Yeah, so my team is gold on a meeting basis. So our sales reps go in, usually meet with clients live or over the phone. Mm-hmm. And everyone on my team is on the hook to deliver 60 meetings a quarter that they schedule or they originate, which are completed by a salesperson. So not pushed or not rescheduled, right? So it's 20 meetings a month, 60 a quarter per
gotcha.
Rep.
How big is the team?
We have 11 here on the East Coast, soon to be 13. We'll finish so we have a centralized team here in New York that supports all of our East Coast operations from Toronto down to Florida. And that team will be between 15 and 18 come year's end. And then we have three in Chicago that is originating pipeline for our Midwest corridor. And then one in San Francisco and one in LA.
Gotcha. So in terms of 20 meetings a month or 60 a quarter, what are you guys going to do to get to that quota?
From a tactical standpoint?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I describe our outreach as multi-touch, multi-channel. And a multi-channel is we leverage LinkedIn and mail. There's some reasons in some markets where LinkedIn messaging works well, particularly after you've connected with a prospect and after they've viewed your prospect and they've warmed up you a little bit. It's big fish in a small pond. Also, email outreach, of course, similar to predictable revenue. And we will typically go 3 or 4 pings over a month period of time, professionally persistent, as they say. And then there's also a telephonic component, particularly in what we call our call windows, which will be first thing in the morning from 8 to 9, and then about right now from 4:30 to 6:30. And it's the reasons you would expect. We are trying to be on the phones when the gatekeeper's not in seat. Because you can navigate a gatekeeper and there's tactical ways to do so, but the best way to get around an assistant is to just be on the phones when the assistant's not in seat. Right? And then also mm-hmm. the clients tend to not be in meetings that first hour of the day or that last thing. And so mm-hmm. ideally, my reps would be on the phone during those call windows and then be leveraging the two other channels through the balance of the day. And then we will also, to the extent that we can, network in real life, tap into our own personal contacts, et cetera.
Gotcha. So for those 20 meetings a month, 60 meetings a quarter, are you measured on a quarterly basis? Maybe talk to me about your goals for your reps and maybe how you comp your team.
Yeah, we are measured on a quarterly basis, and we weren't always measured on a quarterly basis. But I think that the paying quarterly is the right balance. And the reason being is outbound prospecting, which is what we're doing, is inherently episodic. And even if your activity levels are consistently good, you're making the right phone calls to the right people at the right time. You're sending good emails that are short and tailored and personalized. You're leveraging LinkedIn. You're networking, yada, yada, yada. You're going to have good days and bad days and good weeks and bad weeks. There's going to be times when people just keep emailing you back or picking up the phone and you're going to have droughts. And so a quarter period, 3 months, is a long enough sample size for the true results to manifest themselves. But it's not too long of a period for, say, if you were to comp someone annually, if someone's really ahead, they take their foot off the gas, or if they're really behind, thinking there's nothing I can do, I'm going to miss goal. So take their foot off the gas. And so that quarterly compensation structure is deliberate. And then as far as how we structure how we pay, there's a base and variable component. And the variable component is 34% of the base salary. And that's what's paid out quarterly.
Gotcha. So how do you find good people to fill up this quota, 60 a quarter?
Fill up the quota and then to fill up a team that's been rapidly growing. The team was,
yeah, how big?
Yours truly 3 years ago, and now it's, it'll be perhaps 20 across the country come year's end. Yes, I think that talent and talent attraction is the single most important thing, right? So if you have a great process that's ironed out, that really helps. And if you have great onboarding, that really helps. And if you have a great lead gen or SDR sales partnership, that really helps. But if you have great people, they just find a way. And so I think that I, as a team manager, I need to prioritize my time accordingly. And so I might spend a third or even half of my time recruiting and recruiting aggressively. And my personal preference is to recruit directly from undergrad, which is at odds with some of my peers. Because the conventional wisdom, if you get someone with a little bit of experience, they just come with more polish. And you're not going to have to correct a lot of the quote-unquote rookie mistakes. Mm-hmm. But I would rather recruit directly from university for two reasons. The first is I want to be able to mold and shape the people that are on my team and not undo bad habits and not have that this is how it worked at my old company, therefore, why isn't that the case here, right? I think of a talented recent grad as a piece of clay that we're going to make great by really, really investing in. But the second thing is, and I've learned this lesson here in first person, is when I recruit someone straight from school, I get more productivity out of them, because productivity as a rep is just from the time you're ramped until the time that we graduate you into the next role. And so if I were to bring on an SDR who already had a year and a half experience at, you know, in a big sales team, it could be the case where 3 months or 5 months into their tenure here, they're already thinking, I'm bored of this, I'm ready for the next challenge. So that's the second reason why I'm fond of recruiting directly from schools.
Gotcha. Can you walk me through your process a little bit from, like, let's start at the top and what's involved, who's involved?
Sure. Teach me your secrets, master.
Well, first and foremost, we have a world-class internal recruiting team led by John.
That's unfair.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I have the ultimate advantage in having a tremendous internal recruiting team.
One quick question. Right now, is your team centralized at headquarters? Or you said it sounds like they might expand across the country, or are they distributed?
Yes, we actually did not used to be centralized across the East Coast. And we have done away with remote lead gen rep.
You get a centralized, at least.
It is so much harder for me to manage someone like this on video than it is to be able to walk up and grab someone in person. Also, when you send them too. Oh, totally. When you sit in a centralized team, you share best practices in real time and you listen to your peer or your colleague and think, wow, something that he just said doesn't sound good, but I say it too and I should stop. Or a way that he just handled this objection really resonates with me and I want to incorporate it into my reservoir. And also you push one another. If there's a morning where I'm feeling a little bit tired or I'm a little bit behind and I don't necessarily want to get on the phones, but if your peer or your colleague grabs you and is going to call for call with you, it is just so much better. So we have centralized the team, which has been a saving grace for me. But now that is just the East Coast. So the long-term goal for me, the end state, is for a centralized team in Chicago, right? And then a centralized team somewhere on the West Coast, whether it's in our San Francisco office, our LA office, et cetera.
Gotcha. So coming back to the recruiting process there, starts with where you recruit from. What's next?
From where we recruit from. And so we have identified the select schools that we want to focus our recruiting efforts against. And it's interesting. It's counterintuitive because in speaking with peer SDR Legion leaders, I think the consensus is recruit from the state schools because you're going to get more social, more outgoing, and more confident people. And that seems to be conventional wisdom of the skill set for a Legion rep. But we target the top schools in the country. So we've had three or four hires from Harvard. Harvard is the biggest alma mater amongst my team. And we hire from Ivy League schools and the best state schools, the top brand name schools. And the best way that I found to do it is to purchase resume books from those schools. So Harvard, for instance, you can buy a book of all the resumes of graduating seniors who have not accepted a permanent job.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then we go through the resumes one by one, and you're looking for, you know, sales experience. So I just hired someone, for instance, who had experience in college as a door-to-door salesman, but also graduated at the top of our class at NYU. But I love the experience because the grit and resiliency, et cetera. But you're looking for any sort of sales experience, or even better, you're looking for any sort of entrepreneurial experience, right? The elementary school kid who had the lemonade stand, that really works. Those instincts in sales development. And it's funny, people will put that at the very bottom of the resume under their interest and think that it will get a chuckle, but it will get them a job, right? And so I'm looking for that. And then I look at GPA and I look at extracurriculars, not because that's a great gauge of intellectual horsepower, even better, intellectual curiosity, but it just shows how driven the person is, right? If someone was the president of her sorority and was also summa cum laude at Yale, she's got to be pretty hardworking, right?
Yeah.
And so we identify people from these resume books, even though they've shown no interest in joining Axiom, they've shown usually no interest in...
You're prospecting for your prospectors.
100%. Yeah. And then I outbound target them the same way my team outbound targets clients. And it's oftentimes met with resistance because very few of them think that they want to go into a sales or marketing type role. Very few of them.
It's not sexy in college.
No, it's not sexy in college. And so many great field salespeople or sales leaders stumbled into sales, right?
I had no idea.
Yeah. See, that's 30. That's the case with so many people. But what's nice for me is where a lot of 22-year-olds don't think that sales is sexy, and a lot of their parents are pushing them towards law and medicine, right? The beaten path. The company itself, Axiom, is really sexy because it's a growth stage, venture-backed company. It's disrupting an industry.
Well, and sales really isn't sexy in itself, but the skills you get, the life skills you get are sexy in a way. Because if you want to do anything in life, you need to be able to sell yourself product or ideas.
Totally. Totally. Even if it's in one of the industries that mom and dad like law or medicine, you're still selling yourself.
Yeah. Or nonprofit or, you know, whatever you want to do.
Totally. I was just reading an article today about how venture capital is sales. Selling your limited partner and raising a fund, selling your entrepreneurs on joining, everything. So,
I'm curious, how do you sell a recent Harvard grad or a future Harvard grad to take a entry-level sales role with Axiom?
Start with an email. It can either be from my colleague on a recruiting team or from myself. And I introduce myself and I note what in particular about their background or their resume intrigued me. And I say, I want to introduce my company to them. That's it. Okay. Sometimes they respond. Sometimes they don't respond. Regardless, my second step is I get on the phone. I call them. I'm Kyle Richless. I'm calling from Axiom. And I give a quick spiel about the company, why we're growing as quickly as we are, why we're turning the legal industry on its head, and why we're the future. And then I tell them, I want you to come and spend a day in our offices and learn about what we do. I introduce the team. This is a lead gen team. We generate pipeline for our sales team at some of the biggest legal departments in the world. And you may or may not be interested in joining my team or in this sort of career trajectory. But if nothing else, it's going to be interesting for you to have firsthand experience of a day in the life of this sort of growth stage company in this industry. And worst case scenario, you say, okay, this is something I don't want to do. So that's not a hard sell to get them to just come down for a day. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you're at Harvard in Boston, when's the next time you're in New York City? Right. Or come see our Boston office. And then once you get them in the door, we have a beautiful office and a just tremendously talented team here, which is one of the best parts about working here. And then they are what sells the people in the company. I've assembled, I can say this shamelessly because it's true, but we have assembled a tremendously talented, but also fun team. And I think that that's magnetic. And so I'll have someone come spend the day and shadow people on my team. And after they've seen how talented the team is and how fun our office is and the type of energy we have in this office, then I'm also evaluating them. I meet with them during the course of that day. And then I ask them and try to persuade them to enter our evaluation process.
What's your evaluation process? Tell me a little bit.
Yeah. So it can start with come see Axiom for a day, as I just described, or otherwise, if someone says, after I reach out to say a soon to be Yale grad, they might just say, thanks for reaching out. You know, I'd be happy to learn a little bit about you and your company. Start with the screening call, right? Tell me about your background. Tell me about your interests. Tell me what you're looking to do. That is a lot about judging cultural fit, right? But I also, you can gauge for, you know, confidence and whatever else. And if I'm impressed with what I hear after getting on the phone with them for 30 minutes, then I administer a writing sample where I send them a couple of questions about Axiom and I direct them a section of press on our website. Because fortunately, there's been a lot of press, positive press, written about Axiom. And so I have them briefly describe our solutions, our services, and I have them briefly talk about how we're disrupting the legal industry. And then, because from the writing sample, you're judging the ability to craft emails, which is a big part of what we do. And then if that goes well, we have a case study, which is two parts. And it's scheduling a meeting with me, and I play a client, Lisa Snow. She's actually a real person, which I didn't even realize. And then the candidate emails me with a fax that they're given. We shared the same university. We just acquired a bunch of companies, which usually means that Axiom can be a good partner. And so they try to draw commonalities from me, from the fact set, and schedule an email that's warm and personalized and can succinctly explain what Axiom does. Then I write back and say, this is interesting. I've heard good things about Axiom, but I need to get on the phone quickly with you and ask you a few questions before I can commit to carving out time to spend with you. I'm super busy. So then we turn to the second part of the case study, which is get on the phone with me, answer some rudimentary questions about Axiom. But more than anything else, I push back and I want to see if they stumble when I push back, right? I want to see if they lose their confidence. And then finally, I warm up a little bit over this phone portion of the case study and think, okay, maybe this is a good use of my time. We are leveraging law firms, which I aren't super happy with. And I'm looking to see if the person has the instincts to score the meeting or push for next steps. All right. And I put that on the fact set that the goal here is to get time in person. And you get a sense for the sales DNA of the candidate and if they can steer the conversation towards what is your availability look like next week, the week thereafter? Let's find 30 minutes to sit down, right? And then if they survive the both parts of the case study, we'll bring them to the office and have them meet myself again in person and then a couple people on my team. But then also ideally the salespeople with whom they'll partner. Because that sales lead gen relationship is so critical. And if those personalities mesh, everything is so much easier. And then there's a live interview round. And then sometimes this is something that I've recently administered, which I like a lot, but does draw out the process, is after the live interview process, there is a final Skype, which is a feedback session, where I tell the candidate what they did well, but also where they went wrong. And when you're doing a writing sample and live interviews and an email case study, a phone case study, you're going to make mistakes. When I give them feedback, I'm looking to see how it's received because one of the things that we really prioritize is coachability. Mm. So I give a bunch of feedback to try to gauge for what I call the absorb and apply test. And after I give the feedback, I have them redo what they did wrong. So if in the case study on the phone, they handed an objection poorly or described a service of Axiom poorly, I tell them how it can be better, and then I replay it on the spot. And I see if it's met with resistance or if it's implemented and done well.
How does that usually go?
Okay. I like the writing sample too.
Yeah. Writing sample is really telling. It shows you how much time the person's willing to invest, shows you their writing ability. As far as how does the feedback go, I mean, you can get some reactions that are people are taken aback or people are defensive. Or you can get that totally makes sense. Would it be better or would it be more correct if I framed it like this? And you're looking for the latter, of course.
Gotcha.
And then finally, if someone survives that process, it is pedal to the metal to close that person. We should never, ever, ever lose a candidate that we want on this team, ever. No exceptions. And so if I make you an offer, I talk the candidate through what are the attributes that we're looking for that sets someone up for success, not only in this role in lead gen, but for future success and other roles in Axiom. And then I describe to them how they demonstrated those things and why those attributes that they have are going to lead them to have a great career at Axiom. And then we make them an offer and then it is full court press. Everyone who met them should reach out to them, congratulate them, express to them why we want them on the team and how badly we want them on the team. We've assembled a top 10 reasons for joining the lead gen team. And I truly think that this is the best place to cut your teeth if you want to have a sales or marketing career anywhere. And this is a great place to work, frankly. And so we've assembled a top 10 reasons for joining Axiom. And then we'll just check in with people and say, what are your reservations? And what are you feeling good about? What are you not feeling good about? What questions can I answer? And that's the mindset you got to have is you have to close this candidate. Like this is the best sale. This is the biggest sales opportunity you've ever had, and you need to get the signature. And you have to have that mindset. And so our win rate from offers extended to offers accepted is 95% or something really, really high. And I think that as a leader of this team, this isn't something you just delegate to recruiting. Right? This is on me. This is on everyone on my team to make sure that we get that person signed up. So that's the mentality I have. And I think that that's been really critical to assembling a really talented team. And again, I think that having talent is the most important thing.
That's, couldn't agree more, man. You sort of dropped a couple hints at it earlier, but can you tell me about some of the things that you screened for throughout this process?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. This is hardest when you first start the team because you don't know what good looks like. But once you've made 10 hires or 15 hires or 20 hires, it's easier because you have all these data points of what drove success in some and what was lacking in others. And so then you can reverse engineer your talent, your ideal candidate profile, your talent profile. And I have settled on about five things that I think are non-negotiables that we need to have in candidates, or six things if you include cultural fit, that's a given. They got to have your core values. But here are the five things that I'm really looking for. The most important thing in the candidate is sales motor. And sales motor is, do you bring your A game and your effort and the right attitude every day? Whether you're ahead of quota, whether you're behind quota, whether you have the hottest date of your life lined up that night, whether you had a big party the night before, are you self-motivated and driving hard every single day? Because the easiest way to win as an SDR is still to just outwork people. It's the same way to win as a salesperson, right? Activity levels. You got to kiss a lot of frogs. So
It works.
So motor is the most important thing. And how do you gauge for motor? The GPA is telling. Extracurriculars are telling.
Sports
are
intense. Things are like theater can be intense. Someone who's looking to, we also say someone who has looked to take the initiative.
Yeah. Initiative's a good
one. Extra.
Yeah. Sports teams is the obvious one. Cause then you also have the competitiveness too, the coachability. And then references, right? If we're going to be recruiting from the same schools and we're recruiting from the athletic teams out of school, you'd be surprised. I mean, you can find connections to those people and you can ask them, how driven is this person? How many extracurriculars were they involved in? How many initiatives did they start? Yada, yada, yada. So anyway, sales motor is the most important thing. From there, the second one is coachability. And I test for it through this absorb apply test and the evaluation process. And the reason that's so important is the people that are really coachable get better more quickly. But more than that, people are willing to invest in them. The salespeople will give them more feedback, will spend more time with them. They just get better more quickly and they end up being more promising contributors to Axiom. Confidence is the third thing. That one's pretty intuitive. If you're going to be on the phone calling senior level decision makers, you can't be the timid. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But fortunately, that's easy to test for because on the screening call, it shines through. And then on that phone portion of the case study, it shines through. And then when you're sitting down in an interview with me or my colleagues, it shines through. That's the third one. The fourth one is intellectual curiosity. So not just the smarts, but how much do you want to learn? Because we sell sophisticated services and we sell them to sophisticated clients. And you have to be willing and you have to have the interest to really explore our services, our client sets, how we add value, how we're different, how we're better, how we're growing, where we're going. That's just critical. And the people that have that sort of curiosity, they come prepared and they ask you good questions and they show up meeting me, having learned about me from my LinkedIn profile, right? And that writing sample reflects that, right? So curiosity is the fourth thing. And then fifth, you're looking for entrepreneurial instincts or sales DNA. And the phone portion of our case study will show that, right? How someone navigates the conversation with me, pushing back and making them handle objections and see if they can land at a meeting. And we've seen that this is proven true on my team over and over again. The people with the natural sales instincts and that entrepreneurial bent, it's so much easier for them. Especially because a lot of my people are deployed against colder territories. They might not be familiar with Axiom and might not know that there's players outside a big law firm. And so it's through business development. And so those are the five things that I'm really looking for. And as I just described how you test for some of them, but what I'll also do is in the live interview rounds, when the candidate will meet with some of my colleagues, hopefully the salesperson with whom they'll partner, I will tell them, judge this person on the merits to see if you think they'd be great at Axiom. And yes, judge them for cultural fit. And would you like to work with them? But I really want you to go deep on curiosity. Or I really want you to go deep on this person's motor. Or I want, really want you to gauge whether this person has sales instincts or entrepreneurial instincts. And so I'll delegate to certain people who evaluate them one of those five attributes. Aggregate all of the intelligence I get so I can make a more holistic judgment call on, is this person right for our team?
Man, I'm not even sure I could get hired there.
I'll hire Aaron because he's going to sign my books.
Oh. I got it in.
Oh, man. Well, hopefully I can keep this job. Perfect. Man, that's super detailed there.
I will say too, if you've been on the side where you've seen the difference that the people, that, especially when you're building a team, I mean, it's always important, but especially those first one or two or three hires can make, you know, sometimes it's one of these things where sometimes it doesn't matter, but sometimes it makes a huge difference.
What if they have, if they're the right people?
If they've got that sales motor, or gumption, or just, you know, for example, I was talking to a client today and they've got a couple of SDRs, it's newer, they're just sort of dragging. And I think it's just they're not, I don't say motivated, they're just not like, and they haven't been, they're just not energetic. One's just, you know, and they need some, they need some more focus. There's some other things going on there, but it can be hard sometimes when it's new, right? When you are the first one or two and you're not really sure and you're trying to, you know, grind it out. But if you have someone who's just a go-getter, it can make all the difference, even one person like that.
Totally.
Especially at the beginning.
They're a pace setter for the rest of the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
The star performer, and even more specifically than that, the person with the biggest motor, they carry everyone else. It's like the lead horse in a race. They out of all boats. And then also your point about how it's tough to be the first few people. It's so much harder because not only do you not have peer resources to learn from, but when you're first implementing a team, the culture of the salespeople and the behavior of the salespeople might not be used to having an SDR partner. Maybe they're used to being a full cycle salesperson doing their own origination, setting up their own pipeline. So there's behavioral shifts going on too. And so it's hardest to be rep number one or rep number two. And it's most important to nail those hires, but it's hardest to nail those hires because you might not yet know what you're looking for in those hires. And to be completely honest with you, I got lucky with a couple of key early hires that have really driven success here that I'm just super fortunate to have.
Oh, and they got lucky with you. I'll say it.
Sounds that way.
Luck is good.
So how do you identify, I mean, the rock stars just sort of stand out. How do you build out the career path, keep them engaged, keep their minds, you know, over, you know, throughout this role that's can be a bit of a grind sometimes.
Totally. Two things, I think. The first one is career pathing here is bespoke. There is not one ladder that you are expected to climb. For instance, it's not inbound SDR to outbound SMB SDR to enterprise SDR to junior inside sales, yada, 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 the whole way up to field sales. It can be. I recently graduated one of the stars on my team to an inside sales role. I'm great for her. She's going to kick ass in that role. But there are people that are SDRs that might not necessarily end up in marketing or sales or business development roles. And that's fine. That's good. I want that to happen. So I think that the mindset, at least here in this company, of career pathing should not be one defined ladder, because you really want to dig into what is this person motivated by? What skills do they really want to learn? Or what skills do they really want to demonstrate? And also what opportunities might come their way that are going to coincide with the skill set and the interests. So the first thing is, I think that it should be totally bespoke. It should not be hit your number for 6 months and you become this, or and then hit your number for 9 months and you become that. And then the second thing is dig into it early. I think that you don't want to be reflexively career pathing or reflexively promoting people to save them. You want to be ahead of that. By the time someone is ramped up and gold against the fully loaded quota, start having conversations about what pieces of this business are most interesting to you. Who in this organization would you love to become? What opportunities might present themselves next quarter or next year? How is this business growing, right? And so dig in there early, and I have an ongoing dialogue that evolves as the person grows and as the business grows. So here at Axiom, we had that person that graduated into an inside sales role, but we have been growing the business through geographical expansion, but also through service line expansion. And so as we implement new businesses, we're creating new teams, which is new opportunities for people on my team. And so part of my job is making sure that everyone understands that. That if we are going to be launching a new business, they're going to be hiring three people or five people. And I always would rather someone internally raise their hand before we look externally. So those are the two things that I'm really focused on, is dig in early, have an ongoing dialogue and conversation. If someone says, Kyle, I'm really hell-bent on this role or joining this team, make them a map so that if they perform against the plan and show the things that you are looking for, then graduate them into the role. And then think career path, I think, is totally bespoke. Those are my two guiding principles as far as retaining talent.
Can you give me an example of some career paths that you've seen that have progressed outside of sales and marketing? Like, some examples on your team would be awesome.
On my specific team, we haven't had any truly unusual moves. Our head of digital marketing was an SDR, but that's a more traditional move. The person on my team who graduated to a new service is in more of a qualifying role, but it's still a sales oriented role. Mm-hmm. So I haven't had, for instance, that's not true. Our head of product was a lead gen rep once upon a time, but it was 7 or 8 years ago. But I haven't had anyone on my team under my watch who has gone SDR to, say, an engineering role, for instance. But I would be totally open to that. And I'm looking for that. And to the extent that someone has that interest and skill set and opportunity, I'm fully supportive.
Cool. We actually had somebody on our team go SDR, product manager, engineer, which was the weirdest jump that I never would have guessed. And he was recovering accountant of all things.
I would never think accountant to SDR. I mean, I would never think SDR to engineer, but accountant to sales? Wow.
I think I actually asked him, we've got two on our team that are like CPAs. And I was like, in the interview, I'm like, what are you doing here? Like, why do you want to go into sales? And they honestly, for me, they had just a great brain for it. It was a really great fit. They were awesome people. They were frustrated with the industry that, you know, spent all this time investing in their life and their skills and just realized, like, I hate accounting. So, you know, and we've got two people from accounting. We got a bunch of people from the banking industry that jumped on our team. So it's been, I guess it's public now, but it's one of the things we actually actively target and recruit for.
Interesting. I'm going to have to add that to my playbook. It just shows you the SDRs come in all shapes and sizes, and there's not one single blueprint. So it's not just the college athlete at a big state school, right?
Mm. Yeah, man. I was shocked to find that you guys were hiring from like Harvard. That's incredible.
Yeah, you wouldn't think, but and when we hired two more from Harvard about 8 months ago, and it was met with some resistance and some people in this company who I really respect questioning me, like, Kyle, this is not the profile that you would think to recruit from Harvard, because aren't the people from the Ivy League schools going to be more nerdy and less social? But we've gotten great people.
Right on, man.
Yeah. And about Harvard stuff, I've heard multiple times, like, someone from Harvard or Stanford Business School, I don't know about SDRs, but it's just in general, it seems consistent. I don't know, tend to have more of an ego.
Interesting. Well, you were Stanford Business School to sales, were you not?
Yeah, I got into Stanford Business School. Didn't go to start a company. I don't know. I mean, look, I've got my ego, but like everyone else, but I generally think I'm actually more of humble than I balance them too, but I don't feel like it's a big issue usually. I don't know. I've asked my wife.
Yeah. I'm the most humble guy I know.
Well, I'm the firm believer that, you know, everyone needs to get and do the shit work. So I'm always been happy to do that. And then, if I'm going to ask someone to do something, I should be willing to do it myself too, or have already done it.
Yeah. Then you really know what it's like to be in the role, and you can provide better coaching.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had Matt Emmonson on here a couple weeks ago, and he said that was the one key piece of advice for new SDR managers was to actually do the role. So you get that time and seat, you have that actual experience, and it's not just this is what I would do. You're actually talking about, this is what I did. Like, you want to whine about your quota? I smashed my quota every week that I was in that role, right? And lead by experience is one of the things that really worked for him.
Totally. I think not only that, but to have experience generating your own leads, but even better at that company. Mm-hmm. And yeah. What a client sets.
And you know.
I was an SDR for a HubSpot or Salesforce or a really, really well-known and strong brand. I could see people on my team saying, well, Kyle, you don't know what it's like to sell a business that people might not have heard of. Or sell to attorneys that are very risk-averse and intransigent and are stuck in the status quo. And maybe you have a better way, but I'm just going to stick with my offer. Right? But being that I was the one doing it myself, I think that there's some credibility there, but I know what they're going through, and I know product messaging fit, and I know objection handling and starting a conversation. I know when to call and whatever else. So I think that's really important.
How long were you in SDR for?
So I interned here years ago and in an SDR type role. And then I finished law school just after the bar exam and came back, and might've been 8 months before we started scaling the team and I made my first hire.
Right on. So last question for the show today. Can you tell me about one sort of mistake you made in the early days, sort of after you've made that transition from I'm an SDR to now I got to hire and build my team?
Can I give you two?
One and a half.
The biggest mistake I made as a manager is starting people individually. And I didn't learn this mistake until I started people together, but it's so much easier to start people in tandem. It costs more, right? Like it's you can't dip your toe in the water. If you're hiring two SDRs, that might be the same cost as one AE who's actually closing business. So it's easier and it feels less risky to start with one, but starting two people together is so much more time efficient. You train them together and then they also help one another and push one another and form a camaraderie. And then say one of them doesn't work out, your pipeline's not entirely lost, you still have someone. You have a way to benchmark one of them, because in the early days, maybe your quotas aren't right sized. So how do you even really know what they're doing? But now you have a data point. So it's just everything is so much easier to start people in tandem.
Was that both your points and that was just a really bad pun or?
No, that was only one. I'm trying to stick to the rules. I'll give you a quick version of my second one. The hardest thing to do as an SDR and also as an SDR manager is to keep an even keel, because there's highs and lows. Listen, you have a bunch of big wins. Maybe you scheduled a big meeting, got a big demo, qualified a big opportunity, maybe even closed business, and you feel like everything is roses, life is golden. But you might also have really good activity levels and be doing the right things over, say, a week period of time, and you get no results, and you can lose your confidence and then start a spiral. And the same thing as a manager. As a manager, all of a sudden, you're a little bit helpless because you're not directly inflecting the results. And if your team is a little bit behind, it's scary. And if your team's crushing it, it's God's gift, right? So it's hard to keep that even keel. The more experience you get and the more tenure you have, you learn to live with, if my inputs are great and I'm controlling the things that I can control over a period of time, the results will be there. But once you learn to just focus on the place and not the score and control the things you can control and keep an even keel, it's much easier to execute and you're much happier in the role and managing people in the role.
Awesome.
When you do something new, start with two.
When you love that, nailed it.
Right. On that beautiful poem from Aaron, I think that's a great spot to end it. Kyle, thank you so much for coming on the episode today. This has been, we learned so much. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome.